slouching toward Cupertino. "Does anyone know Steve well enough to call him on this?" Emilio asked his staff. Because his encounter with Jobs 2 years earlier had ended badly, Emilio didn't want to make the call himself. But as it turned out, he didn't need to. Apple was already getting incoming pings from Next. A mid-level product marketer at Next, Garrett Rice, had simply picked up the phone and, without consulting Jobs, called Ellen Hancock to see if she might be interested in taking a look at its software. She sent someone to meet with him. By Thanksgiving of 1996, the two companies had begun mid-level talks, and Jobs picked up the phone to call Emilio directly. "I'm on my way to Japan, but I'll be back in a week, and I'd like to see you as soon as I return," he said. "Don't make any decision until we can get together." Emilio, despite his earlier experience with Jobs, was thrilled to hear from him and entranced by the possibility of working with him. "For me, the phone call with Steve was like inhaling the flavors of a great bottle of vintage wine," he recalled. He gave his assurance he would make no deal with B or anyone else before they got together. For Jobs, the contest against B was both professional and personal. Next was failing, and the prospect of being bought by Apple was a tantalizing lifeline. In addition, Jobs held grudges, sometimes passionately, and Gasse was near the top of his list, despite the fact that they had seemed to reconcile when Jobs was at Next. "Gasse is one of the few people in my life I would say is truly horrible," Jobs later insisted, unfairly. "He knifed me in the back in 1985. To Scully's credit, he had at least been gentlemanly enough to knife Jobs in the front. On December 2, 1996, Steve Jobs set foot on Apple's Cupertino campus for the first time since his ouster 11 years earlier. In the executive conference room, he met Emilio and Hancock to make the pitch for Next. Once again, he was scribbling on the whiteboard there, this time giving his lecture about the four waves of computer systems that had culminated, at least in his telling, with the launch of Next. He was at his most seductive, despite the fact that he was speaking to two people he didn't respect. He was particularly adroit at feigning modesty. "It's probably a totally crazy idea," he said, "but if they found it appealing, I'll structure any kind of deal you want. License the software, sell you the company, whatever." He was, in fact, eager to sell everything, and he pushed that approach. "When you take a close look, you'll decide you want more than my software," he told them. "You'll want to buy the whole company and take all the people." A few weeks later, Jobs and his family went to Hawaii for Christmas vacation. Larry Ellison was also there, as he had been the year before. "You know, Larry, I think I've found a way for me to get back into Apple and get control of it without you having to buy it," Jobs said as they walked along the shore. Ellison recalled, he explained his strategy, which was getting Apple to buy Next, then he would go on the board and be one step away from being CEO. Ellison thought that Jobs was missing a key point. "But Steve, there's one thing I don't understand," he said. "If we don't buy the company, how can we make any money?" It was a reminder of how different their desires were. Jobs put his hand on Ellison's left shoulder, pulled him so close that their noses almost touched, and said, "Larry, this is why it's really important that I'm your friend. You don't need any more money." Ellison recalled that his own answer was almost a whine. "Well, I may not need the money, but why should some fund manager at Fidelity get the money? Why should someone else get it? Why shouldn't it be us? I think if I went back to Apple and I didn't own any of Apple, and you didn't own any of Apple, I'd have the moral high ground," Jobs replied. Steve, that's really expensive real estate, this moral high ground, said Ellison. Look, Steve, you're my best friend, and Apple is your company. I'll do whatever you want. Although Jobs later said that he was not plotting to take over Apple at the time, Ellison thought it was inevitable. Anyone who spent more than a half hour with Emilio would realize that he couldn't do anything but self-destruct, he later said. The big bake-off between Next and B was held at the Garden Court Hotel in Palo Alto on December 10 in front of Emilio, Hancock, and six other Apple executives. Next went first, with Avi Tavanian demonstrating the software while Jobs displayed his hypnotizing salesmanship. They showed how the software could play four video clips on the screen at once, create multimedia, and link to the internet. Steve's sales pitch on the Next operating system was dazzling, according to Emilio. He praised the virtues and strengths as though he were describing a performance of Olivier as Macbeth. Gasset came in afterward, but he acted as if he had the deal in his hand. He provided no new presentation. He simply said that the Apple team knew the capabilities of the BOS and asked if they had any further questions. It was a short session. While Gasset was presenting, Jobs and Tavanian walked the streets of Palo Alto. After a while, they bumped into one of the Apple executives who had been at the meetings. "You're going to win this," he told them. Tavanian later said that this was no surprise. "We had better technology, we had a solution that was complete, and we had Steve." Emilio knew that bringing Jobs back into the fold would be a double-edged sword, but the same was true of bringing Gasset back. Larry Tesler, one of the Macintosh veterans from the old days, recommended to Emilio that he choose Next, but added, "Whatever company you choose, you'll get someone who will take your job away, Steve or Jean-Louis." Emilio opted for Jobs. He called Jobs to say that he planned to propose to the Apple board that he be authorized to negotiate a purchase of Next. Would he like to be at the meeting? Jobs said he would. When he walked in, there was an emotional moment when he saw Mike Markkula. They had not spoken since Markkula, once his mentor and father figure, had sided with Scully there back in 1985. Jobs walked over and shook his hand. Jobs invited Emilio to come to his house in Palo Alto so they could negotiate in a friendly setting. When Emilio arrived in his classic 1973 Mercedes, Jobs was impressed. He liked the car. In the kitchen, which had finally been renovated, Jobs put a kettle on for tea, and then they sat at the wooden table in front of the open hearth pizza oven. The financial part of the negotiations went smoothly. Jobs was eager not to make Gasset's mistake of overreaching. He suggested that Apple pay $12 a share for Next. That would amount to about $500 million. Emilio said that was too high. He countered with $10 a share, or just over $400 million. Unlike B, Next had an actual product, real revenues, and a great team, but Jobs was nevertheless pleasantly surprised at that counteroffer. He accepted immediately. One sticking point was that Jobs wanted his payout to be in cash. Emilio insisted that he needed to have skin in the game and take the payout in stock that he would agree to hold for at least a year. Jobs resisted. Finally, they compromised. Jobs would take $120 million in cash and $37 million in stock, and he pledged to hold the stock for at least 6 months. As usual, Jobs wanted to have some of their conversation while taking a walk. While they ambled around Palo Alto, he made a pitch to be put on Apple's board. Emilio tried to deflect it, saying there was too much history to do something like that too quickly. "Gil, that really hurts," Jobs said. This was my company. I've been left out since that horrible day with Scully. Emilio said he understood, but he was not sure what the board would want. When he was about to begin his negotiations with Jobs, he had made a mental note to move ahead with logic as my drill sergeant and sidestep the charisma. But during the walk, he, like so many others, was caught in Jobs's force field. I was hooked in by Steve's energy and enthusiasm, he recalled. After circling the long blocks a couple of times, they returned to the house just as Laureen and the kids were arriving home. They all celebrated the easy negotiations, then Emilio rode off in his Mercedes. He made me feel like a lifelong friend, Emilio recalled. Jobs indeed had a way of doing that. Later, after Jobs had engineered his ouster, Emilio would look back on Jobs's friendliness that day and note wistfully, as I would painfully discover, it was merely one facet of an extremely complex personality. After informing Gassy that Apple was buying next, Emilio had what turned out to be an even more uncomfortable task, telling Bill Gates. He went into orbit, Emilio recalled. Gates found it ridiculous, but perhaps not surprising, that Jobs had pulled off this coup. Do you really think Steve Jobs has anything there? Gates asked Emilio. I know his technology. It's nothing but a warmed-over Unix, and you'll never be able to make it work on your machines. Gates, like Jobs, had a way of working himself up, and he did so now. Don't you understand that Steve doesn't know anything about technology? He's just a super salesman. I can't believe you're making such a stupid decision. He doesn't know anything about engineering, and 99% of what he says and thinks is wrong. What the hell are you buying that garbage for? Years later, when I raised it with him, Gates did not recall being that upset. The purchase of Next, he argued, did not really give Apple a new operating system. Emilio paid a lot for Next, and let's be frank, the Next OS was never really used. Instead, the purchase ended up bringing in Avi Tavanian, who could help the existing Apple operating system evolve so that it eventually incorporated the kernel of the Next technology. Gates knew that the deal was destined to bring Jobs back to power. But that was a twist of fate, he said. What they ended up buying was a guy who most people would not have predicted would be a great CEO, because he didn't have much experience at it, but he was a brilliant guy with great design taste and great engineering taste. He suppressed his craziness enough to get himself appointed interim CEO. Despite what both Ellison and Gates believed, Jobs had deeply conflicted feelings about whether he wanted to return to an active role at Apple, at least while Emilio was there. A few days before the next purchase was due to be announced, Emilio asked Jobs to rejoin Apple full-time and take charge of operating system development. Jobs, however, kept deflecting Emilio's request. Finally, on the day that he was scheduled to make the big announcement, Emilio called Jobs in. He needed an answer. Steve, do you just want to take your money and leave? Emilio asked. It's okay if that's what you want. Jobs did not answer. He just stared. Do you want to be on the payroll? An advisor? Again, Jobs stayed silent. Emilio went out and grabbed Jobs' lawyer, Larry Sonsini, and asked what he thought Jobs wanted. Beats me, Sonsini said. So Emilio went back behind closed doors with Jobs and gave it one more try. Steve, what's on your mind? What are you feeling? Please, I need a decision now. I didn't get any sleep last night, Jobs replied. Why? What's the problem? I was thinking about all the things that need to be done and about the deal we're making, and it's all running together for me. I'm really tired now and not thinking clearly. I just don't want to be asked any more questions. Emilio said that wasn't possible. He needed to say something. Finally, Jobs answered, "Look, if you have to tell them something, just say, 'Advisor to the chairman.'" And that is what Emilio did. The announcement was made that evening, December 20th, 1996, in front of 250 cheering employees at Apple headquarters. Emilio did as Jobs had requested and described his new role as merely that of a part-time advisor. Instead of appearing from the wings of the stage, Jobs walked in from the rear of the auditorium and ambled down the aisle. Emilio had told the gathering that Jobs would be too tired to say anything, but by then he had been energized by the applause. "I'm very excited," Jobs said. "I'm looking forward to get to Reno some old colleagues." Louise Kehoe of the Financial Times came up to the stage afterward and asked Jobs, sounding almost accusatory, whether he was going to end up taking over Apple. "Oh no, Louise," he said. "There are a lot of other things going on in my life now. I have a family. I am involved at Pixar. My time is limited, but I hope I can share some ideas." The next day, Jobs drove to Pixar. He had fallen increasingly in love with the place, and he wanted to let the crew there know he was still going to be president and deeply involved. But the Pixar people were happy to see him go back to Apple part-time. A little less of Jobs's focus would be a good thing. He was useful when there were big negotiations, but he could be dangerous when he had too much time on his hands. When he arrived at Pixar that day, he went to Lasseter's office and explained that even just being an advisor at Apple would take up a lot of his time. He said he wanted Lasseter's blessing. "I keep thinking about all the time away from my family this will cause, and the time away from the other family at Pixar," Jobs said. "But the only reason I want to do it is that the world will be a better place with Apple in it." Lasseter smiled gently. "You have my blessing," he said.